This is Richard Verone, and I'm continuing my interview with Mr. Antoine Roy. Mr. Roy, by the way, it's January 16th, 2003, at 9:35 Eastern Standard Time in the morning. Mr. Roy, let's pick up with where we left off. We talked a little bit about your overall attitudes toward the war. I'd like to go back to April 67 when you got in country and kind of walk us through what happened. One question that I'd like to ask is, could you explain exactly your training as far as the parachute infantry and what was expected of you, what your duties would be, as they explained to you?
Parachute infantry training consisted of two different training periods. Mm-hmm. One training period was conducted down at Fort Gordon, Georgia, mm-hmm. and that was airborne infantry or parachute infantry training, mm-hmm. and it was training for basically light infantry.
Okay.
And it was actual regular infantry training in preparation before going to jump school.
Mm-hmm.
So we had, regular marksmanship, navigation, escape and evasion, weapons cleaning, some basic tactics, different things like that. The discipline was relatively relaxed compared to basic training in jump school.
Okay.
All of our instructors had been to Vietnam again.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent instructors. I think, as I had mentioned earlier, that after having been over there, I realized that maybe there were a few other things that they should have emphasized on.
Mm-hmm. Such
but,
as what?
Small unit assault tactics.
Mm-hmm.
Extreme aggressiveness. One thing that developed in Vietnam because of pressure from back home was to limit casualties.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times initial contact would be made with the enemy and the first thing that we'd do would pull back and then call in artillery and airstrikes.
Right.
Which can be advantageous.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, sometimes not pulling back but attacking immediately can be better.
Yes.
You may take more casualties in the short run,
mm-hmm.
but in the long run, you end up taking sometimes less casualties and inflicting more casualties on the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the realities of war.
And I would imagine you're also projecting an attitude on that enemy that you're being aggressive.
Oh, yes.
You're taking
definitely.
The war to them.
Right. I do think that should have been a little bit more emphasized. But again, there was a lot of pressure
mm-hmm.
from the political and social establishments to keep the casualties to a minimum
mm-hmm.
by people who didn't really understand warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, again, you may lose more men, but you inflict many more casualties and the morale issue on the enemy that in the long run can limit your own casualties. But some people have a hard time realizing that.
Right.
I mean, we, of course, realized none of us wanted to be killed or horribly maimed.
Mm-hmm.
But many guys I've talked to were very frustrated because we found ourselves in a position where if we'd attacked immediately, our advantage would have been so great that we knew that our casualties would have been minimum
mm-hmm.
and enemy casualties would have been maximum. And even if you just chase the enemy away by forcing them to leave their equipment behind, which took an awful lot of resources to get down from North Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an extreme morale blow on the enemy also.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, there was a lot of pressure from the political establishment as a result of the social
mm-hmm.
Pressure, and a lot of officers just, I mean, they were told they were following their orders, pull back, call in artillery and airstrikes. And a lot of times that would give the enemy time to get away
mm-hmm.
or to get down into their very deeply fortified positions.
How often would you be able to change that? Or did your unit, your platoon, your company change, or your squad change those tactics on your own in the moment without having to kind of follow the quote-unquote regulations of pulling back and calling in the strikes?
It generally involved our immediate leadership, platoon leaders,
mm-hmm.
Platoon sergeants, squad leaders, and occasionally individuals.
Mm-hmm.
some individuals, just privates, were extremely aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that could get you killed.
Right.
Because one person being aggressive by themselves is not as effective as it has in the whole squad with you in order to coordinate an attack and gain fire superiority.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, this pulling back didn't happen all the time, but it happened too much. And as the war progressed, it happened more and more.
Okay.
When I first got there, though, they're extremely aggressive because for my first two tours and part of my third, the attitude was we were there to win.
Right.
But after the withdrawal started, of course, that began to change.
Right, right. Let's go back to your training. Let me ask you a question about your instructors. Now, you said that once you had gotten over in country, you saw some things that you wish they had done. Now, your instructors being Vietnam combat veterans, did they teach you just Army regulations, here's what the book says on small unit tactics, or did they say, here's what the Army does, and then here's what the reality is in Vietnam, or did they do a combination of both?
They did a combination of both. They had to train us also in some conventional warfare,
mm-hmm.
because there was a part, we did have a large army in Europe with some tension there,
mm-hmm.
but most of them concentrated on Vietnam. We did have some armored assault training, even one morning of amphibious training from imitation landing craft, although they told us, you know, you'll never do this, but still it's part of the training course.
Right.
They introduced us to some helicopters one day, some armor and the like, but mainly we were light weapons infantry.
Okay.
But every one of them would emphasize that, you know, in Vietnam, things are going to be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be a conventional style war. A lot of them just constantly emphasized, be on your guard. The enemy is very aggressive, usually, especially if you're fighting North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
Viet Cong weren't as aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't as well trained, with the exception of a few units. A lot of them just kept emphasizing, listen to what we're telling you, because if not, you can end up dead.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a constant theme. And it was quite a motivator.
I can imagine. So after Fort Gordon, that basic infantry training, you went to jump school.
Yes.
This is where you combine the two, the infantry training and the jumping, and then this is parachute infantry?
This was jump school was a 3-week course at Fort Benning, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and it was purely parachuting.
Okay.
The discipline was extreme. We had some foreigners from different nations going through our jump school. We had a lot of people that weren't really going to go into combat or be paratroopers, but for a career or officers or NCOs who intended to make a career out of the service,
mm-hmm.
it was kind of important to have airborne training or have that ticket punched.
Right.
Because airborne troops were expected to go a little bit further than regular infantry,
mm-hmm.
To be a little bit more motivated. We also had Navy SEALs who had to be parachute trained with us. And I will say I've never seen men in such good physical condition as those men were. There was a lot of physical training, and the discipline was extremely heavy because you had to be able to react if something goes wrong. And you jump out of that airplane from 750 feet, which is a combat altitude, that you had to be very alert, and that's what the discipline was aimed at,
mm-hmm.
Along with an awful lot of emphasis on aggression.
Mm-hmm.
I had a chance. I pulled an Achilles tendon
mm-hmm.
in the middle of my second week, and I had a chance to get out of the service at that point. They offered it to me, but I refused because, to me, I mean, my goal was to get to Vietnam, be a paratrooper and get to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So for about a week and a half or so, They put me in light duty on crutches with physical therapy, and the Achilles tendon healed completely. And then I rejoined. I had to start at second week again, and then went through the second week and then the third week. The first week was called ground week, and that's where you practice training from jumping out of a tower. You practice training jumping off of platforms, mm-hmm. and they taught you how to land and do what's known as a PLF, a parachute landing fall. Okay. And that's the type of fall where you minimize the chances of breaking bones and the like mm-hmm. By landing on certain muscle groups, especially along your side and back.
Right.
The second week consisted of what was known as tower week, and you jump from a 34-foot tower, and your harness was connected to a cable, and you jumped out, and you're expected to assume the proper position, and then the cable would run you down maybe about 150 feet to a mound where someone was waiting to stop you. Mm-hmm. And the main thing was to practice going into that position as you exit the aircraft. Quite surprisingly, more people were terrified of jumping out of the 34-foot tower than they were jumping off the 250-foot tower or out of the airplane.
Why was that?
34 feet, psychologically, 34 feet, you're closer to the ground, and I think you can anticipate hitting the ground harder or getting hurt, even though you knew you were attached to a cable.
Mm-hmm.
But more people dropped out during that 34-foot tower week than at any other time that I know of.
Hmm.
At the end of tower week, we were attached to a large 250-foot tower with four arms going out on it. And it was like one of those Coney Island rides.
Mm-hmm.
They pull you up on a cable, you know, and then they let you go,
mm-hmm.
but the cable's still attached, except here, the cable just lets you go, and you actually floated down 250 feet. And landed in an area that was plowed earth, nice and soft. And each person was dropped individually, and they talked to you through loudspeakers because you had to avoid hitting the tower if the wind started to blow in one direction. And actually, that was very enjoyable for everybody.
How did you personally adapt to the strict discipline and this challenge of jump school?
I had no problem with it. I can't say I was a very aggressively individualistic person.
Mm-hmm.
I had grown up in a military, for most of my years, grown up with a military, in a military environment.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of knew what was expected of me. I mean, if the lawn in front of our military quarters wasn't mowed every certain period of time, then my father or stepfather would be called on the carpet before his senior officer
mm-hmm.
and very seriously chewed out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those kind of things impressed upon me that, you know, you've got to expect this kind of discipline. And it was also a challenge putting up with the discipline, especially from a harassment point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said previously, the harassment had a point to it. And the point was, number one, keep you alert. Number two, make everybody feel together because everybody was harassed.
Mm-hmm.
And again, take away that, you know, thinking of they're harassing me and substituting it with they're harassing us, which makes you feel part of a team. And if you don't work together as a team, then your chances in combat decrease significantly.
Right. Let's move to April 67 when you got in country and kind of walk us through what you did. I know you said you took 2 weeks there at Benoit in training, combat training.
Mm.
And then, and after that, what happened?
After the training, the company I was going to join, C Company,
mm-hmm.
Was out in the field. They were out in either C Zone or War Zone D or Hobo Woods, I forget, off to the west of Saigon, participating in Operation Junction City 1 to the end of that operation. we finished our training, we did details for a couple of days, and all of a sudden the company came back into the rear for about a two-day stand-down. And they'd been out in the field for well over a month. In this particular case, since Benoit was so close to those areas, they didn't go back into a fire base for a stand-down. Mm-hmm. Benoit was close enough so they could take them back to the base camp. And that's where we first met the guys from the company, and we were quite impressed because suddenly, you know, we were introduced to guys that had experience who regarded us as, oh, God, you know, cherries. Mm-hmm. Cherries are usually were new guys. Mm-hmm. New guys could be a hassle because you had to stop, show them how to do things all the time. Sometimes they could be extremely dangerous because certain things, you know, that everybody knew to do or not to do automatically, a cherry didn't, and could get themselves killed or even somebody else. Mm-hmm. But we weren't treated horribly. I remember, you know, I hear so many times guys saying, oh, I never got close to anybody because I was always afraid they'd get killed. Mm-hmm. And I never, ever, ever experienced that. All the other people that I knew, I met, you know, going between units and the like, I have never, ever, ever, ever experienced that. Hmm. People have to depend upon each other so much that nobody was a loner unless they were psychologically that way.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
People became friends very quickly. And yeah, you had your little disagreements, but some people became close friends. But with everybody else, you were friends, too. And I don't know what people are talking about. I think it's one of those vogue statements that come, that tend to come out sometimes, you know?
Right.
First thing, I mean, yeah, where are you from?
Right.
Was usually the first question. The second thing is, you know, somebody is anxious to take these new guys and show them how to pack their rucksacks the right way, what kind of things to carry, what kind of things to expect, mm-hmm. because you want these guys to be ready to be able to do their jobs as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's for the good of the whole unit. About 2 days after they were back, we went out in our first operation, and it was a Hellebore assault with helicopters. Landed in a large open area next to some jungle. And when I say jungle, a lot of people have an idea about the jungle. It's like the television version of the jungle. Mm-hmm. The jungle is different. There's different flora and fauna, but the feeling is pretty much the same as when you're in the woods around here. Mm-hmm. But I know that when people tend to say the jungle, that they really see something extremely alien. Mm-hmm. And like I said, though there are different plants and the like, and animals and some vines, the feeling is though you're in the woods here.
Okay.
But anyway, as we came in, I didn't realize that the first wave of helicopters, I mean, artillery would hit the LZ, helicopter gunships would fire on it just before we landed. Well, I didn't realize that the door gunners on the first lift landing also opened up with their machine guns as we came in. Mm-hmm. And this was to, you know, try and suppress any fire from anybody who may be hiding there. Mm-hmm. Most LZs were cold, which means there wasn't any enemy, mm-hmm. because nobody intentionally lands troops in an area where they know there's a heavy enemy presence. Helicopters are too vulnerable, and you've got to get the unit organized and everything. So just as before we landed, the machine guns opened up, scared the living hell out of me, and I thought we were under heavy fire. And we weren't. And I remember exiting the helicopter. I was assigned to a guy. You follow me. You stay with me. You do what I tell you to do and the like. And I did. I followed them, and then I was assigned a position in a perimeter waiting for the rest of the... It was probably four lifts altogether to bring the entire company in. Mm-hmm. And they came in. I was a little anxious, expecting, you know, some enemy fire, but there wasn't. And then I was separated from the guy I was supposed to follow by about 20 feet, and I kept looking for him, making sure I knew where he was at all times. And then the whole company got in, we formed up, and we started out. And companies usually moved in a long file by platoons, and they'd rotate platoons, pulling point every day usually. So for the first 2 days, my platoon wasn't on point, but that's where I started to realize just how heavy that damn rucksack was. That's when I started realizing about how hot it can get when you're doing that heavy work. The first night we sat in, there was a probe on one side of the perimeter not too far from me, which impressed me. But it was a quick probe, and then they were gone. These are VC down there.
Did they set off the trip flares and everything? Or
no, there was anytime you stop, you put out what's known as outposts, OPs, and their job is to make sure that no large enemy force gets close to you without some degree of warning. At night, you put out the same thing, except they're called LPs, or listening posts, since it's dark and they can't see. And each platoon puts one out in front of their position, so you'll have three all the way around the company that'll be... I've seen some as far as 100 meters out, which I think is a little too far out. Generally, they were about 75 feet out in front of the company. Also, each night, each platoon would send an ambush out. After we pulled in, started digging in for the night, patrols would constantly be pulling out again to make sure the enemy doesn't sneak up on you in force.
Was this something these squads were reluctant to do, or you knew you're protecting your position, obviously, but...
Oh, we knew why we were doing it, and we knew it was important.
Okay.
Listening post, people didn't really like listening post because it was only four men. And actually, if a large enemy force is coming up to attack you, a lot of times a listening post can be a sacrifice. But everybody knew why you had to have that sacrifice, and it was rotated among people. Patrols during the day were just generally patrols during the day. OPs were a little bit safer. Ambushes were always a little bit, well, we got used to them, but sometimes if you found any trails nearby, anything that where an enemy would tend to come along or travel, that's where an ambush would be set up at night. One from each platoon would be sent out, a reinforced squad usually. And the larger the trail, the more well-traveled, then the greater the chance somebody's coming along. And they'd go out just as it was getting dark and then set up in the semi-dark, trying to make sure nobody saw you set up. And they'd put out trip flares on either side and claymore mines. And those are usually the first things set off. And then usually one man out of three would pull guard, and the other two men out of three would sleep. And you usually pull about a two-hour guard, which is about the same you did on a perimeter. That could be a long 2 hours. Fighting to stay awake could be difficult.
How long had you been in country and been with your company before you were actually sent out on an OP or LP or one of these night ambushes? I'm assuming they didn't send the FNGs out there, you know,
well,
right off the bat.
No, not right out. Well, sometimes. kind of depend upon the situation. They didn't break me in real hard, real quick. I really can't even remember when my first LP was. It must have been 4, 5, 6 nights after we had been out. On the third day, our platoon was the point platoon, and they had a regular guy out point, and then they moved me up to point. hey, Roy, this is your, you know, your first time on point. So, harking back to movies and everything, I pull out this machete, and I start chopping. And after about 100 feet, I'm totally exhausted and can't go any further. And I turned around, and all the men behind me were just kind of standing there, smiling. And they said, Roy, didn't you notice nobody else was chopping anything? And it dawned on me that, well, yeah, they weren't. Mm-hmm. And they said, can you see why you don't want to go chopping your way through the vegetation? Well, obviously, yeah, you're going to be totally exhausted. Mm-hmm. And then they pointed out the other thing was that you start cutting your way through vegetation by chopping, the enemy's going to hear you coming from, you know, a quarter of a kilometer away. We weren't in an area where there was any sign of anything, so they just let me learn the hard way.
Right.
So I felt a little foolish, but I didn't feel overly foolish, because actually their humor was rather friendly. Mm-hmm. So they said, okay, go off point for, you know, a half an hour, and then we'll put you back on point. And this time, keep an eye on the point man.
Okay.
So then I noticed he went around things. Mm-hmm. And the only time you ever really cut your way through something was if it was extremely thick. But usually you have a way of going through brush by turning your back, your rucksack, to one side and then another as you advance. And that keeps one side from getting hung up on branches or vines or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, also, if you're extremely exhausted, you're not going to be as alert as possible. So they put me back on point, and I had learned something. And I pulled point for about the next 2 hours. And right near the end of that, suddenly I looked up. We encountered a trail. I went up the trail a little bit, and I looked up, and I could see a hut. So we stopped. They sent a patrol around to one side, a patrol around to the other side, and then we advanced. And what it was a sort of like a way station for enemy troops. And it sort of like a hotel is. At the end of the day, you know, they get to a certain point, and here's this little hut. And there's a little stove made out of stones and the like, and areas where you could hook up a hammock and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's what that was. It wasn't occupied by anybody at the time. There were footprints around. There wasn't any equipment. But that was the first time I'd seen any indication of the enemy. I was real excited about it.
Really?
And so we burned it, and then we continued on. Now, keep in mind, there are no villages in this area anywhere. And we set up that night. The next day, another platoon was on point, and we came across a heavily camouflaged village. Now, this village was a village that was dominated by the Viet Cong and was inhabited by their families. And it was very, very heavily camouflaged underneath about secondary canopy.
Mm-hmm.
And right in the middle of the trail, as we started to come into it, was a sign in written in English on some cardboard or something. We are friendly. Please do not destroy our village. The village had maybe 20 little huts in it. And there was nobody there. You could see they had just left. A lot of things were still in the houses. These are all made out of, thatch roofs and using large leaves and the like for sides.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember walking past that, and then very quickly, all of a sudden, the word came down, be careful. We just found a booby trap.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember turning around and looking at that sign back there and saying, you bastards. You put this sign up saying we're friendly, don't destroy our village, and then the first thing we do is find a booby trap real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And the booby trap was an American butterfly bomb that hadn't gone off, and the enemy had taken it and rigged it as a booby trap.
Okay.
they found several others also. Now, normally from a village like that, we'd just pass through it, or sometimes knowing the fact that it's hidden, that it was a village housing Viet Cong and their families, and we'd destroy it anyway. If we found villagers, they'd be evacuated to an area where there was less control from the Viet Cong. It may sound kind of cruel, but in that kind of war, you had to get the civilians away from the support that they could give to the enemy. Again, a reality of war, there's nothing new about it at all. It's been used for thousands of years. So we started destroying things very carefully. Picked up a lot of little souvenirs, little things that, you know, utensils or whatever that some guys wanted. I got my first introduction to something called Nuoc Mam.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you had any in Vietnam.
Many times.
Yeah. Gee, I hated Nuoc Mam. The smell and the taste. And I found this jar. It was sealed.
Uh-huh.
And we were smashing things. And I threw it against the base of a tree about 5 feet away, and it smashed.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't believe the odor. And I turned to one of the guys and said, "What the hell is that?" And they were laughing, and they were telling me it was Nuoc Mam, that was this fermented fish sauce
mm-hmm.
that Vietnamese loved. So we destroyed everything. We burned the village. It was marked on a map and everything for intelligence in the future, and then we left. We blew up the booby traps and the like. After we had gone, not even quarter of a kilometer, you know, about 250 meters,
mm-hmm.
There were some secondary explosions from the village. Some hidden
mm-hmm.
Devices had gone off in the fires. And I remember just then not really encountering much of anything, no trails, no. I remember coming across two surprises. Well, I was pulling point, and I looked up, and there was a huge wagon with huge wheels on it,
mm-hmm.
and there was no trail, no road, no nothing, just sitting right there.
Hmm.
And I couldn't figure out how the hell it got there. And we all kind of looked at it as it went by. It obviously had been there for years.
Mm-hmm.
And we continued on. Later on that day, another surprise. Here's a pre-World War II French Renault automobile. Again, no roads, no trails, no nothing.
Just sitting there in the woods.
Wow. Slowly rusting. It still had a lot of the black paint on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, looking inside and the like. The engine had been taken out. It had been scavenged for certain things. The wheels were gone, stuff like that. And I remember, again, being puzzled, you know, how the hell did it get here? And I wonder what the story behind it is.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, we went on. And actually didn't make much of any contact at all after that. And suddenly we had orders to head for an LZ. We were going to be extracted back to Benoit,
mm-hmm.
which was unusual because we'd only been out about a week.
Mm-hmm.
My first night. I don't know if you ever heard of the famous fuck you lizard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the geckos.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought it was one of these silly little rumors and things that we used to hear about back in the States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody pulling your leg. And I was sitting on a position that night. At night, just as dusk has fallen, and in the morning, just as it's getting light, you have what's known as stand to. And during that hour of stand to, where it changes from light to dark, and when it changes from dark to light, everybody has to be on their position with their weapons and ammunition right next to them.
Okay.
Because that is a prime time for an attack. And that was just a constant. We always did this. And I don't ever remember being attacked during that time.
Mm-hmm.
During that period, a clearing patrol went out. And they went out, they had with them the listening post that was going to take over from the observation post.
Mm-hmm.
And the listening post didn't set up in the same place as the observation post. They dropped them off someplace previously determined, and then they'd pick up the observation post, and then the clear and patrol would turn around and come back in. It just perform a U out in front of each platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a final check to make sure that no large enemy forces were out there. It was dropping off the LP, picking up the OP,
mm-hmm.
and starting the night procedure, which is pulling guard.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting there on position, and we talked, but very quickly you learn to talk in very low whispers.
Mm-hmm.
You have, like, noise discipline, light discipline, no lights at all, no
right.
fires.
Right.
You learn how to light a cigarette down inside your hole or whatever. I was sitting there, and I was whispering to a guy, and the third guy said, "Hear it?" And I said, "Hear what?" And he said, "Fuck you, lizard." I said, "What?" He said, "Listen." And I listened, and I listened, and I heard this, "Arco, Arco, Arco." Well, you had to use your imagination a little bit, but that you could interpret that as "fuck you."
Right.
And I said, "I'll be damned. There is such a lizard." I never ever saw one.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was a little gecko type of lizard, but I never saw one.
But you heard it.
But I heard it.
Was that quite often? You heard that in
at night? Oh yeah, down south especially. Yeah. When I went up to Central Highlands, up there we heard mainly gibbons,
uh-huh.
Apes, and I didn't know until well after the war that I was listening to an ape. And this is usually at dusk,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it was a bird, because they make this sound kind of like, ooh, 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 and I thought it was a bird.
Mm-hmm.
All those years, I was watching television one night as a documentary on apes, and I was reading, and all of a sudden I heard it,
mm-hmm.
and I looked up, and I'll be damn, that was an ape. But anyway, up north, it was usually in the lowlands, those little geckos were.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they pulled us out, like I said, after about a week, which was very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And we got back, and they told us that they were starting this operation called Operation Winchester. And Operation Winchester was the whole 173rd Airborne Brigade was being transferred up into the operational control of the 4th Infantry Division in the Central Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole brigade had to pack everything up, and we were flown north in C-130s within 2 days, and we landed at an air base near Pleiku,
mm-hmm.
Campanari,
mm-hmm.
and which is the 4th Infantry Division base camp.
Right.
And then from there, we were immediately put into trucks, and this is the only time I ever did this, a long convoy. There were seats in the middle facing out on each side, and that long convoy with headlights on and everything sped down this road to an old fire base from the old initial Yatring Valley campaigns by the 1st Cav,
mm-hmm.
called the Oasis. And I was really kind of stunned we were doing this at night.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole operation happened so quickly, and it was in complete secrecy, so that the enemy didn't know it was coming, and they weren't able to prepare anything.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been a few enemy troops along the road, but they weren't about to make contact with this huge convoy with 40-millimeter dusters and quad 50 machine gun trucks and helicopter gunships flying overhead.
Mm-hmm.
So it was uneventful. It took about 30 minutes. The truck's moving very fast, and we arrived at this old fire base called the Oasis, which was outside of a Montagnard village, I remember. And we were there for a while, and at that time, a lot of the old-timers from the second group that came over, replacing the guys that finished their first yearly tour,
mm-hmm.
A lot of them left, and my platoon was, well, we were, TONC was 44 men in a parachute infantry platoon, and I believe we dropped down to 16 men.
Wow.
And that's extremely small.
Mm-hmm.
And we went on patrols and, like, around the Oasis, Went through a Montagnard village for the first time. Mm-hmm. The Montagnards were there. They were friendly.
What was that like, that village?
Oh, that was right out of the National Geographic.
Really?
Yeah, Montagnard people were, they're Aborigines.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship is the same between American Indians and Europeans mm-hmm. when, you know, back in the 1700s, 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
Also went out, went through a tea plantation, patrolling, and this kind of freaked me out. It was owned by a Frenchman.
Mm-hmm.
I had never seen tea before, and I remember we went through the tea, and suddenly off to the left was this huge white mansion, looked like something out of the Deep South.
Mm-hmm.
And on the porch was the French plantation owner and his family, and instead of black servants, there were Vietnamese or Montagnard servants. Dressed in, you know, just like you'd see a black servant, a white coat and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they were having tea or lunch. We weren't allowed to go too near the house. We passed by, oh, I don't know, maybe 100 meters or so. And I remember, my God, right out of the Deep South. And what I had known at the time, and, you know, we were told, well, this guy here paid off both sides. He paid off the communists, he paid off the South Vietnamese so that he could run his business.
Mm-hmm.
And he would not divulge any intelligence to either side. He'd come to an agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And both sides got taxes from him.
Okay.
So he was allowed to exist. So we went on, and I remember we came out of the tea plantation, went down the road a ways, and then another platoon made contact further down the road. I remember we raced down the road in a combat formation, which is one file on either side of the road,
mm-hmm.
and two men from each a little further into the woods, so that if anybody's waiting in the woods for you to come by, these two men called flankers, they'll generally run into them first.
Mm-hmm.
They can be a sacrifice, but if you think there's any enemy nearby, you always put out flankers.
Right.
Because if not, you're going to get ambushed bad.
Mm-hmm.
We got there. The fighting was over. They killed a few North Vietnamese, hadn't suffered any casualties. Went back to the oasis. Mainly were waiting for replacements, and replacements started coming in. And then we got up to about, oh, I don't know, three-quarter strength. And we were sent out to this very beautiful primeval area and marched for about 2 days. And I remember it was just so beautiful. I remember going around a huge rock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, massive rock. And it was a cave in one side. And inside this cave rose to about 30 feet high,
mm-hmm.
maybe about 30 feet wide, and went back in maybe about 80 feet. And inside was a Montagnard building that they put them up on stilts.
Mm-hmm.
And we very cautiously went in. It was empty. Hadn't shown any sign of recent use, so we just left it. I remember being a little intrigued by that, but the terrain was just so beautiful in the jungle. We ended up on a ridgeline, and we set up a fire support base and did patrolling out of that. And what I found out about 2 days after being there is that we were on a fire support base overlooking the Yatrang Valley.
Okay.
And some of our patrols went down into the Yatrang near where the battles had taken place in 65.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time that I contracted malaria.
Okay.
Even though we were taking one pill every day,
mm-hmm.
the Dapsone, plus the big orange pill once a week,
mm-hmm.
I came down with it. I was evacuated, but by the time they got me back to the rear, the attack was over, and they can't tell anything through a blood test unless they take it during the attack.
Mm-hmm.
And I was brought back out again. I didn't know it was malaria. I had no idea.
How did you feel physically?
Physically?
What happened to you?
It started out with slight shaking, hands shaking, and then shaking more and shaking more and shaking more, and starting to feel weak, and then starting to feel warm, and then nauseous.
Mm-hmm.
But but because we were taking the medication, the attack was very limited. I never had a full-blown attack until I got back to the States afterwards, after everything was over, and wasn't on the medication anymore. On top of which, back here, the doctors didn't recognize it until finally one did. And he said, you know, gee, in medical school, jaundice, high temperature, very high temperature, shaking, heavy nausea. That reminds me what they taught us was malaria. And he said, I think you ought to go to the VA hospital. And my sister took me in, and sure enough, that's what it was, 5X malaria. But of all the attacks I had in Vietnam, I didn't know what it was because they were over so quickly that by the time they got me back to an aid station to draw blood, there was nothing to see.
About how many times did you contract malaria?
Oh, gee. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 6 times, I guess.
Well, was that unusually high, or was that about average?
No, that was very high. I don't remember that many people coming down with it. A few, but not that many. It's like hepatitis. I only remember one person on my last tour getting hepatitis.
Right.
But as far as any diseases, we were very healthy, actually. The only problem was jungle rot. And that's usually a problem during the wet season. When we arrived up in the Central Highlands at the oasis when we first went out, it was during the monsoon season. And we didn't run into it there. It was monsoon season, a little bit further to the north. Mm-hmm. We operated around this fire base, had a few probes and the like, but nothing serious. I ran into, first time I experienced and realized just how dangerous it is for a bunch of guys to be walking around carrying all kinds of pyrotechnics. I remember an accidental discharge, luckily didn't hit anybody, and then we had this big sump where all the trash was burned on the fire support base. And I remember being near this big sump and an explosion took place. And one guy got some minor shrapnel, and they could tell by the shrapnel that it was a grenade. Well, we used to get resupplies of grenades and like all the time, and apparently they come in a big box with about, I don't know, maybe 24 grenades, something like that in them. And apparently one had been left in its slot. Somebody had noticed it and then thrown the box into the fire as trash, and it went off. Those kind of incidents, I mean, they're accidents. And they weren't that uncommon, along with people actually being killed by accidental discharges. I saw that twice, and those were horrible. Especially the first one I saw was just terrible, and I still feel terrible about my reaction to it. But
can you describe that? Or
well, that's getting into the very next section here.
Okay. Let me ask you a couple of general questions so far. You've been in country, I guess, about a month or so, and you've experienced being in the field down in the south and being in the field up in the Central Highlands. Can you talk about, just in general, the difference in terrain and the difference in kind of your tactics and what you did in the two different areas?
Down south, the land was relatively flat. Mm-hmm. It was generally double canopy. Single canopy goes up to roughly, let's say, 15 feet. Double canopy will go up to maybe 30 feet. Triple canopy, where you have, like, mahogany trees, they'll go as high as 200 plus a little bit.
Okay.
Biggest trees I've ever been around.
Right.
And very dark inside sometimes. But the terrain always changes. Down south, you can go through these thick, viney areas, and then you can go through maybe rubber trees where all the trees are in line, dressed right and covered down kind of. And no matter, you turn left or right, and everything's in a line because they were planted that way. You can run into bamboo, little bamboo forests and the like, where it's mainly just bamboo trees. Further up in the Central Highlands, But generally the bamboo is about maybe up to 1.5 inches in diameter. You get up into the Central Highlands, and I've seen bamboo over 1 foot in diameter.
Wow.
I've seen bridges, like little bridges on the River Kwai, mm-hmm. made out of bamboo, and it's all tied together with strips of bamboo.
Mm-hmm.
Bamboo comes even larger than that, up to 2 feet wide, I think. I saw a National Geographic thing on it. But I was quite surprised that it was that big, and it's very strong stuff. But in the Central Highlands, you had mountains and hills, and some of you had valleys. You may have plateaus and the like. It was much less inhabited than down south. There were less Viet Cong and a lot more North Vietnamese. Most people think of the jungle as being empty and having to force your way through the brush. And most people don't realize that actually the jungle is covered with trails. And that's the way this country was when first Europeans arrived. Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of the roads up here in New England actually follow old Indian trails.
Mm-hmm.
And there were trails all over the place, mainly used by montagnards or by North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't hard to find a trail, usually. Now, if it was going in the general direction we were heading in the Central Highlands,
mm-hmm.
we'd follow it for two reasons. Number one, if it's a well-used trail, your chances of meeting the enemy coming down the trail not knowing you're coming
mm-hmm.
were good. And when you're the hunter and they're not expecting you, you've got that little edge.
Right.
Also, if you're looking for the enemy, follow the trail. That's where you're going to find them. It also gives you intelligence information about what routes they're using. The more well-used the trail is, the more people are using it. Some trails are very old and be starting to be overgrown. Others were as wide as 5 or 6 feet, very well packed.
Mm-hmm.
We used to call those speed trails. And those were the highways in the jungle compared to like a secondary or tertiary road here.
What about the fear of booby traps and mines and things?
We were always on alert. They were a greater danger in some areas than they were in others. I ran into them, but I didn't run into as many as some guys did, like in the area around Chu Lai, a lot of the areas down south. But we were always very conscious of them. And usually, surprisingly, most of the ones that I saw, they weren't even hidden that well. I don't understand how they expected us to not see them. The first suspicion was that, well, they wanted us to see it, and maybe they had a little mine planted around it.
Right.
So when we went up to attach a C4 charge to it to blow it, you know, somebody get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But I never ran into that. I've heard of plenty of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you run across anything that's suspicious, sitting in the trail, out of place, somebody would always put a little piece of white toilet paper on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you go by, you'd point to it so that the man behind you, and you'd make eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see that he could see where you're pointing.
Right.
And that meant that it's suspicious. Leave it alone. Don't step on it. Don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd just go around it. But if it was a definite booby trap, the engineers, we usually had about 4 engineers attached to a company, they'd blow it up because we wouldn't want the enemy coming back, picking it up, and then resetting it someplace else.
Right.
Sometimes if it was real obvious, like a grenade and a line attached to a pin coming through, you just go over and push the spoon down, take the pin out, or push the pin all the way in, and turn the things over,
mm-hmm.
Because when you blow one up, you're giving away your position.
Right.
And then later on, they'd be detonated all at once.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, if we found an American grenade, we wouldn't use that grenade because you can substitute a fuse for a 7-second fuse to an instantaneous fuse,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you don't know if it was booby-trapped like that.
Right.
So we wouldn't use them ourselves again. But there were also, down south I ran into punji steaks a lot. When I got up north, not as many. Those were usually a Viet Cong kind of thing. These real crude man traps that you saw in the early movies and the like, I never really ran into too many of those. I think I saw one, but it was so obvious. I mean, it was a mat over a hole with some punji steaks in it. And you'd have to be blind not to see it.
Right.
These big swinging things with spikes in them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever know anybody that ever saw anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, right after, well, we'd gotten up to, like I said, we were going through this beautiful area. We set up a fire support base. We knew it was overlooking the Ashell Valley. We sent patrols down and the like. Then I had my first attack of a malaria. Then they pulled us out of that and moved us north to Dak Tho, because the word came down our 2nd Battalion had been sent to Dak Tho. 4th Battalion had been sent to the Cambodian border outside the Etring Valley. 1st Battalion, I don't know where they were. 3rd Battalion wasn't in country yet. But A Company, 2nd Battalion, had been wiped out up in Dak Tho. So right away they loaded us on Chinook helicopters and flew us north. And the Dak Tho region was in the monsoon period at the time. And that's where you ran into jungle rot. Because if you're dirty and you're wet, basically it starts with just a little cut that gets infected, and you end up with a scab floating on pus. And the cure is very simple. It's you stay dry, and you take a shower twice a day, and you can almost watch it shrink. But you weren't allowed out of the field for it, because everybody had it. And the only time you're allowed out of the field is if it approached any sort of orifice. Your mouth, if it got real close to your mouth, your nose, your eyes, your ears. And usually it was only in an exposed area of your body, especially in your arms is where it started. I had it in my arms and on my face and the like. It's real miserable. You also had something called crotch rot. Very, very red and irritated and swollen. Medic was treating me one day, and I said, "What kind of disease is this?" And he said, "Disease? It's not a disease." I said, "Well, what is it?" And he said, "You never seen babies?" And I said, "Babies? Yeah. Well, back in the States, this is what they call diaper rash. And it's from, you know, the baby being moist all the time and not being potty trained, you know." And again, the cure for that is just staying clean and dry,
right.
And it goes right away.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff that they use was similar to Desidin that they use on babies.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't wear any underwear because it was too hot and it would chafe. And we were told to let testicles hang down a little bit because testicles are supposed to be a couple of degrees cooler than the rest of the body. So nobody that I know of wore any underwear.
Okay.
Anybody who did, it was always a boxer short kind of underwear.
Right.
So all we wore were boots, socks, pants, jungle shirt, and helmet.
Okay. Tell me about what you carried in your rucksack. You mentioned that earlier about what you learned quickly, what not to take and what to take. Tell me what you did take.
You didn't carry anything you didn't have to carry.
Okay.
We were on a 5-day resupply. Later on, that was reduced to a 3-day, but that was after I left the 173rd. When you had a unit like the 1st Cavalry Division, which had so many helicopters, and I went to that unit next, I was stunned that in the morning we'd take out hot meals to them and a hot breakfast. And a lot of times they'd put their rucksacks on the helicopters, and we'd take them in and then take it back out to them at night. And I was really stunned about that. Also, from my point of view, it didn't make a lot of sense militarily, because because when those helicopters landed with the food and then to pick up the cans, the Mermite cans, the food came in afterwards, he just pinpointed the position of that unit to the enemy.
Right.
And when he came in that night, you pinpointed the position of that enemy again.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch, you know, each day, you can kind of see what direction they're going in.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, yeah, well, it may have been good for morale, but they probably should have been on a three-day resupply because you don't want the enemy to know where you are or what direction you're going in.
Right.
Because, number one, they could run away. Number two, they could prepare a party for you.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the CAV. 101st, we were on a three-day resupply when we were in the mountains.
Okay.
But in 173rd, we didn't have that many helicopters, and we were on a five-day resupply.
Okay.
So initially we carried 3 sea ration meals per day, which is a total of 15, which adds up to a lot of weight. Later on, they tried reducing it to 2 meals a day, but young teenagers working extremely hard, even though nutritionally it was enough, it kind of broke down morale. We were always hungry.
Okay.
And you have to practice food discipline. You don't eat all your food. You've got one meal 3 times a day, you don't eat any more than that because you're not going to get resupplied until, you know, the 5th day.
Right.
And don't go asking somebody else for their food.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with water. You practice water discipline. And one of the worst crimes you could ever commit was stealing somebody else's water
mm-hmm.
or food. That was very serious.
Did that happen often at all?
No. If it did ever, it was taken care of within the team or the squad.
What would usually happen?
Somebody get the hell kicked out of them.
Okay.
But he carried that. I carried, depending upon the area you were in, if you expected to meet any heavy enemy forces, a rifleman, basic load was 200 rounds of rifle ammunition, but most of us carried 400 rounds.
Okay.
Basic load was, for hand grenades, was 2, but most of us carried minimum of 4, and I carried either 6 or 8. Basic load for smoke grenades was 2, and that's what most of us carried. Some guys like to carry a white phosphorus grenade. White phosphorus psychologically is very useful. And then, let's see, each one of us carried 1 Claymore mine at least. In a bad area, I'd carry 2. Each man carried at least 1 trip flare already attached to a stick.
Okay.
For quick setup. I would carry 1 of those, and then I'd carry like 3 in my rucksack not set on a stick. Because in certain situations, you could pull the pin out in those things and throw them out in front of you or behind the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And they are incredibly bright. You can't look at them. You'll lose your night vision. Even during the day, they're extremely bright, and they can be very distracting
mm-hmm.
if they're thrown into the middle of an enemy position.
Mm-hmm.
You could also use them for marking, and they didn't weigh that much, you know, maybe about 3/4 of a pound.
Okay.
And then there was your shaving equipment, some writing equipment, and then each man carried 1 gallon of water. And it's when I was in Vietnam, I remembered probably during my 6th grade or 7th grade science class
mm-hmm.
that a cubic foot of water weighs 64 pounds.
Okay.
And I realized very quickly just how heavy water was.
Right.
I carried 2 regular quart canteens and a 2-quart canteen that was generally known as a fat rat.
Mm-hmm.
And most people carried that much, but you had to ration your water. In the mountains, there was more water available in streams
mm-hmm.
Caused by the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And then the machine gun had to have a certain amount of ammunition. And though a machine gun team was authorized to be a machine gunner and an assistant machine gunner and an ammo bearer,
mm-hmm.
we never had enough men to have an ammo bearer.
Okay.
And a machine gunner could carry only so many rounds because he's carrying a machine gun. Plus his regular stuff. the assisting gunner could only carry so many rounds because he's carrying a spare barrel for the machine gun, plus some extra parts, plus his ammo. So a can of machine gun ammunition was issued to a certain number of men, mm-hmm. and you had to carry it in a squad for the machine gun. We had a weapons platoon in the company that carried 81-millimeter mortars. Well, there was a very small platoon. The mortar itself, which broke down into three parts, the mortar, the bipod, and the base plate were very heavy. They had ammo bearers, but they couldn't carry enough of the mortar rounds themselves. So, again, some men were allocated a mortar round to carry. We had a can of albumin, which was an emergency blood expander. If you lost a lot of blood and you're trying to maintain blood pressure, the medic would take your can of albumin and give you like an IV with it. You couldn't live a long time on it, but the thing is it put volume into your system so you could maintain blood pressure. And every man had one of those.
Okay.
We also had some pop-up flares, maybe two each. We were all issued gas masks, but gas masks were usually combat losses within 24 hours after they were issued. In other words, they were tossed off into the woods.
Right.
And I'll be damned, the one time they used gas on us, nobody had a gas mask. But they were considered, you know, just, we don't need it, and infantrymen are always trying to keep the load down.
Okay, go ahead.
Every other man carried an entrenching tool, and the odd man or even man, and then the other one would carry a machete.
Okay.
The entrenching tool was heavier than the machete, but not everybody could carry one. We did have to have machetes when we set up at night. We cut fields of fire in front of us. We cut stakes to build overhead cover for the bunkers we had that we built. We dug a hole big enough for three men to get into, chest deep, and then each man carried 10 empty sandbags. And the sandbags were filled with the dirt that we took out of the hole and then piled on each side, and then thick branches, maybe about 2 inches thick, were laid across those and sandbags put on top of those.
Okay.
And that was in the case of mortar and rocket attacks. Now, I was never one, and a lot of guys were never one, to want to get inside of a bunker, because usually the enemy would come in underneath their mortar attack because they're hoping that you've got your head down. And that's when they can penetrate the perimeter and attack the bunkers. And me and a lot of other guys, we took our chances outside. We might snuck, one guy would be on one side of the bunker, one guy would be on the other side of the bunker, snuggled up, you know, against the side of the bunker, and then one guy would be inside the bunker. But we wanted to be able to see clearly all the way around.
Right.
Also, three men firing from this hole, approximately 6 feet long. That's one grenade, one rocket, one good machine gun burst, and you take out the whole position. If you're outside the position during an attack, you may fire for a couple, 2 or 3 minutes, and then you roll, if possible, away just a few feet because if somebody's seeing the muzzle blast coming from day or night, coming from one area, then they're going to be shooting back at that area. So if you roll away, then your chances of being hit by return fire are a little bit less and surprising the enemy, because they may change direction of attack and suddenly, you know, you've changed your position and somebody's right in the direction they're attacking from. But I just was not one to be in a cramped, enclosed area. I wanted to be able to see what was happening, and I'd take my chances during a mortar or rocket attack.
I've heard these attacks described by other veterans as one of the more harrowing things they had to undergo while there.
Yeah. I've been in worse things. Mm-hmm. I've been under some very limited artillery fire on Hill 875 and Dock Toe. But they told us that some of it came in, but we couldn't tell because we had our own artillery firing. Mm-hmm. I hear about the Marines talking about heavy artillery fire mm-hmm. up north, and those are much larger explosions. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine being under the ordnance that we used to drop on the enemy. I mean, 500-pound bombs are just incredible bombs. It's just, I can't describe to people just how incredible they are. Napalm, 105-millimeter artillery, which was our average artillery, but 8-inch artillery. Mm-hmm. That is a huge artillery round. Mm-hmm. 155-millimeter artillery is big. 4.2-inch mortars are big. Mortars have the advantage of firing very high and coming down straight. And I know that even North Vietnamese saying that the mortar fire in some battles was the thing they feared the most. Usually you could hear the mortar round. You might be able, if nothing else is going on, you'd hear the mortar tube, you know, as the, mm-hmm. the ground went down the tube and then fired. Mm-hmm. And
how far away could you hear that?
Oh, you could hear that up to a kilometer.
Really?
Sometimes further. And then just before it hit, if it hit near you, mm-hmm. you'd hear this real quick, like that, and then the explosion. Because a mortar round's not traveling as fast as an artillery round. Mm-hmm. And an artillery round, if it's close enough to hurt you, it's coming in so fast, you don't hear it. Mm-hmm. If it's going over your head, you might hear it coming in. Mm-hmm. In fact, I can remember artillery firing way over our heads at an enemy position or for a pre-plotted defensive fire, mm-hmm. and it'll sound like a big object flying through the air, kind of a... And the larger the round, the larger it sounds, mm-hmm. and an 8-inch round, I swear to God, you'd think there was a big Cadillac going through the air up there that you couldn't see. Uh-huh. It was that big.
Wow.
What we used to drop on them... It was just, I can't imagine having 500-pound bombs dropped on me, napalm, this heavy artillery. When you called for a fire mission and you knew you were right on, they'd fire one round white phosphorus so you could tell if it was going to hit mm-hmm. the target. If it was off to one side, then you'd tell them to make this one adjustment, and then you'd tell them to fire for effect. And for a 105-millimeter battery... That's 10 rounds per gun, and there's 6 guns in a battery. Mm-hmm. So you're firing 60 rounds, and it's just, it's devastating. Mm-hmm. You had to be very well dug in for it, because mm-hmm. if you're out in the open, it's very dangerous. Mm-hmm. If they're heavily dug in, sometimes, too, they'd fire fire for effect just to blow down some tree cover, mm-hmm. and then they'd put a 1 or 2 second delay on the next one. So that it would penetrate into the ground just a little bit and then go off. Mm-hmm. So it could penetrate the top of a bunker. And sometimes if it went into the ground, you know, even near the bunker, it could cave in the bunker.
Right.
They do this also with 500-pound bombs. Mm-hmm. 1,000-pound bombs are just, it's a hole 30 feet across and 15 to 20 feet deep. Mm. And it's just... Vietnam, to this day, I can remember when I was flying over Vietnam, you know, one of the choppers, mm-hmm. You'd see all these bomb holes and the like everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I hear they'd fill up with water quickly. Mm-hmm. And we used to call it, you know, the land of 10 million little frog ponds. Well, I hear to this day they're still used as little fish farms. Mm-hmm. And they're still very visible. And I've seen films from the First World War where these huge craters are still visible. Mm-hmm. So I think Vietnam's going to, if you fly over, you're going to see these little frog ponds for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the weapons that you carried personally. Besides, you described the grenades and such. You carried an M60, is that correct? Or
no, at first I carried an M16. I was okay. A rifleman.
Okay.
Then I was assigned an M79 grenade launcher. which is a good weapon. The only problem is the round has to go 20 feet before it'll detonate. That way you protect yourself and your buddies from the shrapnel coming backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a single-shot weapon.
Right.
You fired the round, you broke it open like a break-open shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
You took out the empty cartridge, which looks, and put in a new one. And the new one looked like a great big 45 caliber bullet, except it was 40 millimeters in diameter, and fired a small grenade that had a potential fatal range, a radius of about 5 meters. You could kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time it wounded the enemy. North Vietnamese were quite afraid of that weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it was a very dangerous weapon for us, too. The safety on it was not very good. It very easily and without notice went off safe.
Okay.
I carried a machine gun for a very short time on my first tour,
mm-hmm.
and then I carried an experimental shotgun with 15-round magazine. But very quickly it became obvious it was about as heavy as an old BAR,
mm-hmm.
and the magazines were huge,
mm-hmm.
and it was very heavy. It became our report, basically. I carried it for about 3 days, and then a couple other guys carried it. And our report was that for a static defense weapon, like a fire support base with a
mm-hmm.
bipod on it,
mm-hmm.
it'd be great, firing 12-gauge double-aught buck.
Mm-hmm.
But for carrying around in the jungle, no, it was just too big and it was too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a 12-gauge has a hell of a kick.
Yes.
Most 12-gauge shotguns carried were pump, Winchester or Remington pump shotguns.
Mm-hmm.
I never carried one of those.
Okay.
The M16, when I first got over the 173rd, was the original M16,
mm-hmm.
which had a problem with jamming.
Right.
The biggest problem was that the chamber was not chrome plated. Now, when the bullet fired, it threw off a lot of this junk from the explosion, the combustion.
Mm-hmm.
And in just a steel chamber, it would get a little pitted, and some of this carbon burn off would get into the pits. And then when a chambered into the weapon, the cartridge, of course, expanded a little bit when the bullet fired.
Mm-hmm.
And with all these little pits and with all the combustible material in it from previous rounds, it would be sticky.
Mm-hmm.
So when the bolt went back, which was supposed to pull out the empty cartridge, eject it, go to the back, and then come forward, pick up another round, throw it into the chamber, sometimes the ejector wouldn't be able to pull the back of the fired cartridge out of the chamber,
mm-hmm.
but it would still go back, and then it would start to come forward again. It would pick up a round and try and throw it into the chamber, but the empty cartridge was already there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then you had to stop, pull the bolt back to the rear again and lock it. You had to take an M16 cleaning rod, put it down the barrel, ram out the stuck cartridge. And it's going to stick again. So very quickly you had to loosen a pin, kind of break the weapon open. It turned down on a pivot bolt in the front.
Mm-hmm.
And you put like a chamber brush in there and kind of turn it back and forth real quick. And then you should wipe it out with a little cleaning cloth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to try and do this while you're in action, of course, it's not good.
Right.
You've got to stop firing and everything, and if the enemy's attacking, you're going to end up with not being able to defend yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And my very first heavy, immediate combat, I was on a position with one other person in a valley with grass maybe 3 feet high. And we were on an old trail that hadn't been traveled, it looked like, for years.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened to me. North Vietnamese came along. My friend was sleeping while I was just sitting on my helmet.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing voices. My first impression for some reason was that they were South Vietnamese or Montagnard CIDG, which is sort of like militia. And so I figured, well, gee, I better stand up so they don't, I don't surprise them, and they just, you know, boom, pull the trigger. And I stood up, and I looked over and saw right away there were North Vietnamese, and they were about 20 feet away, the first one. Mm-hmm. And the first one was turned around talking to the second one behind him. And as I stood up, as I was standing up, it dawned on me, then again, it could be the bad guys, but I had the barrel, I was holding the weapon by the very end of the barrel. When I stood up, the guy in front had it across his chest and the like. He actually was in a better position to get to his weapon before I could get mine up from my shoulder. The guy behind him, who was looking at him and talking to him, glanced past him as I stood up and saw me and stopped dead. The first man saw that he stopped and turned around and looked at me. And started to lift his weapon, and to this, even then and to this day, I don't remember getting my weapon to my shoulder. I did it so quickly.
Right.
And I fired four rounds. I hit him, knocked him back off the second man, fired two more rounds, hit the guy behind him, and then got down. My buddy jumped up and is saying, where? And I'm pointing out, there.
Mm-hmm.
So they're starting to fire back. My buddy and I are firing at them, and all of a sudden my buddy says, Roy, my weapon's jammed. So I fired about three more shots, and I'll be damned if my weapon didn't jam, too.
Oh, jeez.
And just then, the squad leader came up from one of the other two positions. We were in a kind of a circle formation to see what had happened. And we both said, he was from Ecuador. His name was Marco King.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, Marco, we're jammed. Pull up the slack. Well, he threw up his rifle, fired one round, and his weapon jammed.
Oh, God.
So here's all three of us with jammed weapons.
How many enemy were there?
I saw approximately 10, but the ground went down and then dropped down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So my impression is there was probably about a platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And but they were caught completely by surprise. Like I said, they were just talking as they were going along.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a slight inkling they were there before, you know, they knew we were there.
Mm-hmm.
Right away, all three of us started pulling out grenades and throwing grenades.
Mm-hmm.
And then Marco said, Roy, go back and bring up the gun, which was the machine gun.
Right.
And I ran back to the next position. I told him, bring up the gun. And then I said, I need cleaning rods. Our weapons are jammed. So two guys gave me two cleaning rods. By the time I got back, the machine gun was in position. And once that machine gun started opening up, it pretty well dominated everything. The enemy split up and ran. But it was, like I said, the land dropped off a bit, and we couldn't see them. And I'll go into what happened right after that later on.
Okay.
But
was that your first experience with combat? Seriously?
That was my first real direct, right in front of me. And it was one of those things that I think every GI wondered before combat, would I be able to kill an enemy soldier if it comes down to this face-to-face thing?
Mm-hmm.
And it taught me that, yeah, there would be no hesitation whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up killing three of them. We lost one man killed for a bullshit reason, which I'll explain later on.
Okay.
But anyway, about 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, we were issued the M16A1.
Mm-hmm.
The M16A1 had a chrome-plated chamber, and they also changed the ammunition a little bit so that the powder didn't throw off as much residue. After that, I never experienced the jam. I don't recollect anybody in any unit I was in experiencing a jam at all. I have heard of some saying there were some, but I personally am not aware of any after that.
Okay.
And we had full confidence in the M16 after that.
What was your favorite weapon?
I preferred the M16. A machine gun is a lot of fun to fire,
mm-hmm.
But in certain situations, especially if you're a grunt gunner, which is an infantryman machine gunner. Once you open up, you better keep firing, and you better get the enemy, because being such an important weapon, being able to put out so much firepower, the enemy is going to do everything they can to knock out that machine gun. When I was a door gunner in a helicopter, I loved it. I really loved that weapon. It had a rate of fire that was slower than the communist equivalent, which was the RPD, but I thought the rate of fire was perfect. It was about 500, 550 rounds per minute, which was kind of like bap, 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 bap. The enemy machine gun fired, and I think you were able to follow the tracers. At first, you look through the sights to find your target, and you fire. A good machine gunner doesn't fire continuously. It's 4 to 6 round bursts. And you fire, and you get in on the target, and then you look up over the sights, and you follow the tracers, which are 1 out of every 5 rounds. And then you see where the bullets are hitting, and then you make your adjustments from that there. And it was just, machine guns are devastating. They're terrible weapons. But I preferred it over the faster-firing RPD. The only thing I saw about the RPD that was better was the drum magazine underneath. We fired belts. They had an assault pack that you could put 100 rounds in. But I've always felt that a drum was a little bit better. The only negative thing is that the weapon had to sit a little bit higher up off the ground to accommodate the drum underneath, which exposed you a little bit more.
Right.
But to me, the M60 machine gun was a fantastic machine gun.
Was there any weapon that you wished you had but did not have in the field?
Pistols. Usually, you know, some of us would gather pistols from the enemy or, you know, get them from somebody else. But then periodically, we weren't allowed to have them. Only officers, machine gunners, medics, and the like were allowed to have pistols. Pistols are dangerous for accidental discharges. And periodically they'd come around and they'd confiscate all the pistols from people who weren't authorized to have them. But they are very, very handy in certain situations.
Of course. Yeah.
And in closed situations, things like that. I would like to have been able to carry a pistol. I had an accidental discharge with a pistol that belonged to a medic. Luckily, I didn't hit anybody. But, you know, it made me leery. I don't own a gun. I would love to own a weapon. But I saw so many accidental discharges in Vietnam, just pure accidents, just like car accidents, that, you know, I'd much rather not have them. And I suffer a lot of heavy depression, and I'd much rather not have it around for that purpose, too.
Right, right.
The M79, which I was talking to you about, once we got up to Dock To, like I said, this company had been wiped out, A Company, 2nd Battalion. The company commander had broken primary rules of combat. He was in the mountains up above Dock To Special Forces Camp, and they had broken camp for the night, and he sent a platoon down the hill in the direction that they were going, just ahead to go and patrol a little bit ahead, and then the other platoons would join up with him. Well, that platoon got, 100 meters down, something like that, maybe 200 meters down, and all of a sudden ran into a battalion from the, it was either the 24th or the 66th MVA regiment. And the battalion reacted very quickly and overran them and shot all the wounded. The final radio messages coming from the platoon back up to the company commander was that, my God, we're being overrun. Come on down and help us. Well, he broke a rule, and he sent down one more platoon. Well, by the time that platoon got down there, the first platoon had been all chewed up, and the enemy in battalion size was fully deployed, so they just chewed up the next platoon. So they're screaming for help, and the company commander then sent down the 3rd Rifle Platoon, who suffered the same fate.
Jeez.
And only a few men were able to scramble back up the hill. Now, the prime rule of combat is never commit your forces piecemeal
for
that reason. And he broke the rule. There was another company, a sister company, a kilometer away, and there was a trail, a nice trail along the ridgeline going over to where A company was. But the company commander from the other company, a kilometer away, figured that this was a, might be a classical guerrilla tactic where you attack an enemy and then you set up a force to ambush the relieving force. So he made as good a time as he could, but he put out flankers and he did it correctly. Now there was no ambush set up in that area. They didn't realize at the time that it was a random meeting. So by the time he got there, the company commander of A company had realized he'd just lost all three of his rifle platoons. He only had his weapons platoon, which was real small, and his headquarters group, and he realized if they went down there, they'd suffer the same fate. So they didn't go down. I'm sure that officer was, well, he was relieved of command, obviously. His career was finished, and he was probably reassigned to, I don't know, a stevedore unit or something. But
do you think this is one of those guys who was in it, you know, for the 6 month combat to get a help his promotion?
Unfortunately, that's what officers served over there, lieutenants, out of a year's tour. They served either six months in the rear and then 6 months in combat, or 6 months in combat and then 6 months in the rear. And this was to give them experience in the other forms that are necessary to support infantry. You have to have experience, especially in logistics. You have to be a logician to be a successful officer. Intelligence, things like that. And it was actually, it was a bad thing to do. Because by the time the officer really got a lot of experience, it was time for him to go and to do his rear service time or to go home. And he should have been out in the field for the full year. The Army, it had a good idea, but it was misdirected. And it was a real mistake. Because most of these officers were in for just, I mean, I had a chance to go to OCS, even though I knew I wouldn't make a career out of the service. I turned it down because I was afraid the war would be over before I got there. But most of them weren't going to make a career out of the service anyway. That's the way the Army did it, and it was a major mistake. They meant well, but there was no forward thinking on it.
Did you ever witness any tension between these lifers and the enlisted men?
The lifers?
The
you
ones
mean like
the officers?
Sergeants? Some, just where, you know, there's always some guys that are jerks. There's always a few. But generally, you know, I mean, my first platoon sergeant was a Hungarian who had fled during the Hungarian Revolution and then joined the American Army. And he was on his second tour. And he was always honest about keeping spread out in open areas, making any noise, you know. And, yeah, we were young and, you know, a little bit rebellious, but he was tough. But after he left, we all realized that he saved a lot of lives, and he was doing his job. Most of the sergeants I had were pretty good. I mean, I know of a couple of jerks, but there's always a few. And when the term lifer was used, if you were talking to somebody that you knew was going to make a career, it was used humorously, generally. I did see some tension between, well, probably only one time, between a platoon leader and the platoon, the lieutenant. But everybody hated this guy. Even the company commander hated this guy. That's, I might even have brought it up to you earlier. I'm not sure.
I think you did.
Oh, you asked me about the fragging thing. Yeah, I think I did. Anyway, when we got to Dock Toad in the monsoon, we were, we landed, and we were walking down one side of the runway, and we looked across, and there were 76 body bags in line out of the company's. We're never at full strength. The only time I saw the company at full strength was one time. and they lost probably 80% of the men. The vast majority of the killing wounds were close range to the head. That made us realize that we were up against a very dangerous enemy.
Mm-hmm. Was that common? Executing the
yes,
wounded?
Yes, it was. Okay. It was. Some people have tried to apologetically explain it away as well. Guerrillas, they can't carry wounded prisoners with them. They got to get the hell out of the area. But our point of view was, hey, the man is wounded, leave him.
Right.
Because it's a military fact that for every wounded man, it takes at least two other men to take care of him. And you've effectively taken those men out of combat.
Mm-hmm.
You're using up more resources by your enemy by wounding the man, and you're demoralizing because people see something, somebody moaning and groaning, or a guy goes home when he's lost a leg and he's in the hospital. It's more depressing for the folks back home,
mm-hmm.
you know. To go off and murder him like that, no, that was not. We were real upset about it. Fact of the matter is, for about a month afterwards, maybe 3 weeks, I don't know. It's hard to judge time when you're out there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
2 or 3 weeks afterwards, if we did capture an enemy soldier, we killed him. Until higher headquarters found out about it. Battalion headquarters wasn't upset because, hey, it was one of their companies that had been murdered like this.
Mm-hmm.
Higher headquarters heard about it and very, very, very heavily sent down the message that will not be tolerated and any man doing that will be courts-martialed.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also sent down the explanation that, look, a prisoner is worth his weight in gold,
mm-hmm.
because they tend to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, just innocent things they say can tell you an awful lot about the enemy and their condition. They like to look them over physically, give them a physical, see if they're malnourished, if it looks like they've had malaria or other diseases. And a lot of them just talked voluntarily. Others, if they didn't talk voluntarily, were generally turned over to a South Vietnamese combat police unit.
Mm-hmm.
When they weren't in combat gear, they wore a white hat, and they were known as the White Mice. And the White Mice were generally composed, and most of the police, were composed of men who had their families or relatives murdered by the communists.
Mm-hmm.
The communists would do this in a village to enforce discipline. So these men hated the communists, and they will make somebody talk, or they'll kill them, one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, a lot of them would talk. So it was very important to capture prisoners.
Mm-hmm. What was your general impression?
It was hard to, because they tended to fight. They weren't as fanatical as the Japanese,
mm-hmm.
but they would tend to fight real hard and to the end a lot of times.
Can you distinguish between the NVA and the VC in that matter?
Up in the Central Highlands, it was just about all NVA.
Mm-hmm.
VC, my experience with VC was limited, mainly down south and a few up north. And you can tell a difference. A lot of times, North Vietnamese are more Chinese-looking. The eyes are a little bit more slanted. The cheekbones are higher because of the heavy Chinese influence.
Mm-hmm.
Where South Vietnam was inhabited by the Chams up until about 1637, and the area up to just north of Saigon used to be Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
So the features are different. They're more round. They're more soft. The cheekbones aren't as high, the eyes aren't as slitted-like.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there were a lot of North Vietnamese down south that we had evacuated at the end of the French War, so you could not automatically assume. But if you captured a prisoner out in the field in the Central Highlands, he may be in civilian clothes, but he was sent in for questioning anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're about the same. If they were sent to the white mice. If they were real dedicated communists, well, you know, they're tough. They're harder to get information from.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, they'd be sent to the white mice. The communists were extremely brutal. Oh, God, were they brutal. So I don't have a real hard time with forcing information out of somebody, especially when being in the field, that information could save the lives of our men.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things, times where I could consider it excess. I don't believe in brutality, just as a general purpose. In fact, most of the time, we captured North Vietnamese, and we couldn't necessarily get a helicopter in to get them out. And a lot of guys would, you know, unless they had guard position, things they had to do, one or two walk over, and I have, you know, and sit down, and facial expressions, hand gestures, body language is universal.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew a few words, and, you know, carry on a conversation with them,
mm-hmm.
throw them photographs, stuff like that. When I was in the hospital, it was a POW section of the hospital, and we used to go down and talk to them through a fence. I saw a couple of guys playing chess with them through the fence,
mm-hmm.
And they were always asking for cigarettes. I guess they weren't allowed too many, so we were giving them cigarettes. But it was mainly curiosity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What
was your impression of them when you would go over and speak with them when you're out in the field?
Them and, you know, even looking at their dead and the like,
uh-huh.
you saw that we were roughly the same age. I remember once up in Dock To going to the relief of one of our sister companies that was on the verge of being wiped out. There was a wounded North Vietnamese laying on the trail, and we stopped just then to check something out. And he was laying right in front of me, just a few feet. He'd been hit in the head. I believe it's shrapnel,
mm-hmm.
and his buddies had put a bandage on him and then had to flee, and he was completely out of it. He was just kind of, and he was rubbing his hand over his face,
mm-hmm.
and I remember the hill off to my left going down, that side of the finger was so steep, he didn't have to worry about anybody trying to get up there, so mm-hmm. I remember watching him and not feeling any anger, but at the same time not feeling any compassion, just watching him and realizing, you know, he's about my age, and he's probably got a family and everything, and, you know. And then all of a sudden the word came, okay, go on. So we went on, we went down, saved the company. When I came back up, he'd apparently died, and somebody had kicked him off the trail. And he had rolled, it was in a bamboo forest on the side of the steep finger, and he had rolled down about 5 or 6 feet until he rolled up against some bamboo, but he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he died from the wounds.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them generally, my impression was it wasn't too hard to get them to talk.
How would you get them to talk?
It wouldn't be us. It would be back in the rear.
Okay.
Sometimes if we had an interpreter, we generally treated them halfway decent, an interpreter, if we had one, might talk to them, but you might find out what unit they were in,
mm-hmm.
you might find out how many men had been with them at the time, you might find out what direction they were going in. They had heavy security inside communist units. Communist units were broken down into three-man cells. And each man was supposed to keep an eye on the other. And they only knew what they had to know at the moment, so that if one of them was captured, he knew very little.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like us regular infantrymen.
Mm-hmm.
We knew very little except what was going on at the moment.
Right.
Which we resented, actually. We always wanted to know a little bit more about the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
But so a lot of them, but if you captured an officer, that was real important.
Mm-hmm.
The only time is if you captured a commissar. Commissars enforced discipline. They were the heavy, hardcore communists. I know that, you know, kind of regarded, if we realized they were a commissar,
mm-hmm.
a lot of times we didn't, regarded them with a little bit of suspicion. If they were Vietnamese with us, though, they wanted to kill them. Commissars
just right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. The commissars were the ones that gave the orders that if the communists want a village to stop cooperating with the South Vietnamese, well, they'd go in, they'd pick a house, they'd bring somebody out, and they'd kill them right in the street, make an announcement to everybody that if there's any more cooperation with the South Vietnamese, they'd be back to do the same thing, except they'd double the number.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't anybody in particular they were looking for, and usually they'd kill the village, the head of the village, or a teacher, any sort of intellectual, well, they just some poor sucker who they happened to find. Shoot them, walk away, and the message is sent.
Mm-hmm.
They were extremely brutal people. And the commissars were usually the ones that gave those orders. They were the real hardcore ones.
Mm-hmm.
So the Vietnamese hated commissars. But, of course, they were important for intelligence reasons. Sometimes they could be broken.
Mm-hmm.
But if the Vietnamese caught them, generally, I heard a commissar didn't live very long.
Yeah. What do you think were the strengths of the enemy?
Their very heavy isolation and the limited amount of information that they had. They didn't have access to the amount of information that we had.
Mm-hmm.
We had come from another country that was completely different. We knew what. You know, a great degree of freedom was, individual freedom and group freedom. Personal initiative is involved with Western soldiers,
mm-hmm.
whereas communist soldiers were very strict and rigid. If they had an attack plan and something went wrong,
mm-hmm.
they would follow that attack plan still, rigidly. Western officers and Western soldiers, you know, are shown, hey, if something's going wrong, don't keep doing it. Try something else. Most communist armies, if you tried something else and it didn't work, you could end up shot.
Mm-hmm.
In our society, you wouldn't be shot. It was just a simple mistake, I mean, things you didn't know, it wasn't held against you. If it was gross negligence, like that officer, that company commander that committed his forces piecemeal,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he wasn't shot, but boy, he paid a hell of a penalty for it in a way. And I'm sure if he's alive today, he's still carrying the weight of that on his shoulders.
Sure.
But
was that a weakness that you saw?
That was a main weakness with North Vietnamese and Vietnam. Any communist army was like that.
Okay.
Very, very, very rigid. They were very tough. They were a very worthy enemy. We had a great deal of respect for them. And everything I've read since then is they had a great deal of respect for us. If they were dug in and they intended to stay dug in, I mean, they would fight right to the end. A lot of times in a random contact or something, they'd run. But an orderly withdrawal,
mm-hmm.
because they'd rather prefer to fight on their own terms, especially if you're outnumbered.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, I think also they had the impression, the feeling of being the hunted.
Okay.
Because we were always searching, these search and destroy missions.
Mm-hmm.
They were mainly just hunting for enemy units. So there's no doubt they had the feeling they were the hunted.
Mm-hmm.
And though you try and turn the tables, still that's got to have some sort of an effect upon you. They also knew what could happen with heavy firepower. Tactical air support, heavy artillery, and that must have had an effect upon them. And I got to admire, we'd drop just so much on them, and we'd attack and still run into a wall of fire, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were different. Sometimes they'd run without putting up a fight when they were dug in,
mm-hmm.
but most of the time you could expect them to fight. And regardless of casualties, cannot believe, you know, after some of their attacks, the number of bodies laying out in front of us and how they could continue fighting after taking casualties like that. Even if there was no TAC air or artillery, you know, a sudden attack, just, you know, our firepower was such that it was horrible. But they keep on doing it. I guess they were trained to expect it. But again, what they only knew is what they were told because they didn't have access to alternative ideas.
Right.
There was only one party allowed in the North, and that was the Communist Party. So a lot of them did surrender. We used to drop billions of these little slips, and I wish I'd saved one. All over, in fact, we're very guilty of littering all over Vietnam. And it was a safe conduct pass.
Mm-hmm.
And if you turned yourself in, you'd be treated well. You wouldn't go to a POW camp. And you would get money depending upon what you told or what kind of a weapon you brought with you when you surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
The more powerful the weapon, the more money. A lot of these people were very, very, very discouraged with the communist cause. They were demoralized. They were basically losing on the field. A lot of them were very individualistic people who didn't like the repression and the heavy discipline even back in North Vietnam. And a lot of them came over to us, an awful lot of them, with this pass. And this pass was called a Chu Hoi pass.
Mm-hmm.
And Chu Hoi meant open arms.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who had one was known as a Hoi Chan. And we had them surrender to us, and a lot of them turned and became what was known as Kit Carson Scouts. And they came with us. We'd have, like, three of them assigned.
Did you have trouble trusting these guys?
Some guys did, yeah. Most of them spoke no English. Some of them were very friendly. I've got pictures of guys in another platoon with three of them. And they're acting like they're Viet Cong who captured them, you know, in these different poses and everything. Usually they were pretty good. I mean, they could tell the little signs and indications that were left. And actually, we should have been trained in that. The information we got from them, they should have trained us. But they could also act as interpreters. Some of them were extremely bitter and really hated the communists. There were quite a few that came over.
How would they usually surrender to you? Can you give me a few examples?
Well, if they found out where you were, they had to get away from their unit first.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they were ever caught with one of these passes in their unit, that would have been instant execution.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to get away from their unit. They had to find out where you were someplace. Usually they try and find a static base, but if they knew where you were set up and they could get away from their unit, they'd put their hands in the air and yell and wave the pass and everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go out very carefully to make sure it wasn't a trap and have him keep his weapon high in the air and have him come to us and then take the weapon, frisk him, and let him keep the pass in his hand, you know? And usually we'd say, Chu Hoi, or Hoi Chan, Hoi Chan. And he'd say, yeah, Choi, Choi, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd take him prisoner, but we'd keep him guarded.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd send him into the rear.
Okay.
And then after that, you know, they went through a process where they were interrogated. And some were either made Kit Carson Scouts, some joined the South Vietnamese Army. Others went on probably allowed to be civilians under a cover name or something.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were ever caught by the North Vietnamese of the communists, there was only one thing they could expect, and that was death.
Right. How much contact did you have with Arvin?
Limited, but with Montagnard forces.
Mm-hmm.
Montagnard forces were excellent. We had one squad attached to each platoon up in Doc To, Doc Siang, and end of the road, Highway 14, as far as you could go at Duck Peck. It's way out in the middle of nowhere. They were very good fighters, very friendly. used to carry these old World War II weapons, M1s, BARs, grease guns, Tommy guns. And these people are so small, an M1 rifle or BAR were taller than they were.
Mm-hmm.
But they were good, tough troops generally, as long as they had some good leadership. Mm-hmm. And they usually had American Special Forces leading them.
Right.
They did not trust Vietnamese. Again, the relationship was like that between the American Indian. And they were also very loyal to the French when the French were there.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that Special Forces units, which led Special Forces troops, which led Montagnard units, a lot of times Montagnard units would go out and half of them would come back with no weapons, no ammo.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say, oh, combat loss. So they were replaced,
mm-hmm.
the weapons and the ammo.
Mm-hmm.
But the Special Forces people knew what was going on. And the weapons and the ammo were being concealed, buried someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Montagnards had learned that, and knew that, like the French before, we wouldn't be there forever.
Right.
And they'd end up fighting the Vietnamese again.
Right, right.
So,
especially in Laos.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They were hiding the stuff for later on.
Yeah.
South Vietnamese, you had Rough Puffs, which are regional forces and popular forces. Popular forces were the lowest
mm-hmm.
on a militia level, and they were a typical militia. American militia during the Revolution really couldn't depend upon them all the time. In fact, at the Battle of Cowpens, General Daniel Morgan put the militia in the front line, put the provincial troops in the second line,
mm-hmm.
and within earshot of the militia told the provincial troops, if the militia does not stand and wait until the order for them to fire their one round and then pull back, you're to shoot them if they try and pull back any quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to the federal troops, called the Continental Line, behind the state troops and told them the same thing in earshot of the state troops.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, militia's militia.
Mm-hmm.
They're not that well-trained. Towards the end of the war, they became very well-trained and very well-led, and they fought very hard and very well during the last two offensives.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't know that. But when I was there, I mean, I've been with some popular forces that were so-so. I remember one time just disgustingly no discipline at all. And regional forces, a hair better. Some South Vietnamese regular infantry divisions I've been with were damn good. As good as any American unit,
mm-hmm.
Easily. The 1st Infantry Division, the Marines, the Rangers, the South Vietnamese paratroops. You had some units like, for a while, the 5th Arvin Division was lousy, but then it became much better. The 18th was lousy, but then at the end of the war, they're the one division that really made a stand and destroyed about 3 North Vietnamese divisions before they ran out of bullets.
Mm-hmm.
So they got much better. It's just that it takes time to develop an army.
Do you think they were accurately portrayed in the media, the South Vietnamese forces?
No, they were always put down.
Right.
And it was, you know, I mean, we had our small defeats and the like. But when the South Vietnamese had a small defeat, it was overblown. There was this one battle called Ap Bac,
mm-hmm.
and the South Vietnamese were just slaughtered in the battle, and the press really built it up time and time again. Well, what they never said afterwards was that the South Vietnamese went back to Ap Bac about a month later,
mm-hmm.
and the battle was completely different. They just completely destroyed the communist forces.
Mm-hmm.
But that never really made the news.
Right.
They were just very, very, very biased towards the South Vietnamese and never really understood how it takes time to build an army and a leadership group.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the tragedies of the war.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever work with troops from other countries, the ROCs or New Zealand, Australia?
I met Koreans once,
mm-hmm.
Down around the Tui Wa area.
Mm-hmm.
Koreans were generally known as very tough troops, and I can remember reading, we got Stars and Stripes about every 5th day or so, and it was a very, they reported bad news along with good, you know. But we get these things about South Koreans. They get into this battle around a village or something, mm-hmm. and they'd kill 300 and lose 2 men. And we're going, wow, how the hell do they do that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, keep reading. And then finally I found out what it was. South Koreans are very brutal. Mm-hmm. I mean, they took sniper rounds from a village. They just plain flattened the whole village before the people could get out. Mm-hmm. And then they'd count all the bodies. And that would go in as the body count. Mm-hmm. They were very, very, very tough troops. And I think their attitudes towards communists and the like was very hardened by the Korean War. Mm-hmm. I met a Korean after the war who had been in the Korean Navy in Vietnam. But generally they were considered very excellent, reliable troops up until the very end of the war when everybody was starting to pull out. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, their reaction was the same as a lot of other people's. But generally they had, what, 2.5 divisions, mm-hmm. Mainly in coastal pacification. I often wonder if they hadn't been used, you know, a little bit deeper inland. If it wouldn't have been better, but there may have been some, you know, language barriers or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I'd met Australians, didn't really work with them, but met them. Mm-hmm. In fact, they used to be part of the 173rd for a certain period. And in the 173rd Association right now, one of the main chapters is the Australian chapter. Let's see. Seen Filipinos. So I haven't operated with them. Who else?
About any Thai?
No, I know they were in country. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Thai Queen's Rifles or something like that, which was a division. But Thai forces were very heavily involved in Laos. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know that they were up to like 2 or 3 divisions of Thais mm-hmm. in Laos. Fighting the war up there. They were known as friendship battalions.
Right.
Because the lowland Laos were very pacifistic people. The Mayo and the equivalent of the Vietnamese Montagnards are all related. They were very tough, but they were running out of manpower after years of fighting. And the Thais fought very well mm-hmm. In Laos. And culturally, Thailand and Laos, they're very closely tied, cultural, the language, everything. Mm-hmm. So that's where they were willing, and also to defend their northern border. Mm-hmm. But I never met any in Vietnam.
Okay.
So.
Did you ever encounter any Pathet Lao troops or Khmer Rouges?
No. Okay. No Pathet Lao, no Khmer Rouge. I've read about them a lot. Mm-hmm. I never encountered any.
Okay.
Mainly Montagnards and South Vietnamese.
It seems a common thread in the story of the Vietnam War of how loyal the Montagnard troops were and how fierce they were they would fight.
Right. Well, they had 2 points of view. Mm-hmm. Number one, the communists were just as brutal with them. Mm-hmm. The communists would tend to want to break up tribal societies mm-hmm. for centralized control.
Right.
And that was something the Montagnards were terrified of. Because most Asian peoples are, you know, the family and the clan are everything in the tribe, mm-hmm. and the Montagnards even more so. They saw what happened to the Montagnard groups in North Vietnam after North Vietnam had gotten their independence from the French.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, just the Vietnamese in general, who were taking the best land and the like. And it's a real shame because there was a bigotry by the Vietnamese towards the Montagnards, and it was always an issue. Well, during the early part of the war, it turned into violence and the like.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always an issue during the war. Some Vietnamese were very dedicated to Montagnards, but generally there was some bigotry, just like there was early towards Indians. They were considered savages. Because technologically they were way behind. I mean, they didn't come out of the Stone Age until probably 1900 or so,
mm-hmm.
When the French introduced them to things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot lot of the, there were animists mainly, but there were a lot of French missionaries up there, and they had this unusual mixture of animism and Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But I really respected them. I mean, they were, and it was, to be around people that primitive, like I said, you know, right out of National Geographic.
Mm-hmm.
National Geographic, 1967, I forget what month, was a place called Doc Peck, and then another one called Ann Lack. Well, I was up at Doc Peck. That was as far, far as you could go,
mm-hmm.
Out into, on Route 14, and I got two copies here. It was April 1968,
mm-hmm.
and I was there in August or September 67,
mm-hmm.
and they show the village that had been attacked and all the people taken off as forced labor, the incident that brought us up there,
mm-hmm.
and I believe it was the Jeh. What was the tribe in that area?
Mm-hmm.
But it gives you a good idea with photographs and the like,
mm-hmm.
And descriptions of what the Montagnards were like.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't worry about, you know, them holding their part of the perimeter or anything. Mm-hmm. Some South Vietnamese troops we never worried about.
Mm-hmm.
Rough Puffs were the only ones we kind of worried about.
Right.
But the presence of Americans would tend to stiffen their spines a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew that they were going to get air support, artillery support immediately, and they knew that the guys on the other side of the perimeter were known to stand and fight.
Mm-hmm.
So,
did you ever work with K-9 units?
Yes, a lot of times. And we always welcomed having scout dogs. They were excellent for point.
Mm-hmm.
They, of course, could smell and hear something. And I wish we had had them constantly. But we didn't. We only had them for about, possibly 1 week out of a month when I was with the 173rd, but we should have had them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they, of course, could smell out an ambush very easily.
Mm-hmm.
They were German Shepherds.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one huge dog, and his name was Buddha. And we had him several times, and this dog was so dangerous, I mean, to anybody except his master.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't go near Buddha. The other dogs, as long as you were an American, yeah, they let you come up and pet them.
Right.
But you did not go near Buddha, and you didn't say anything with a threatening voice to his master. I mean, this dog would rip you apart. And the handlers used to tell us back in the rear, the dogs would be tied up, and they'd hire Vietnamese with long sticks to come in and hit them in an area that would only cause pain,
mm-hmm.
not injury, and to use the stick to take the food away from them.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was, of course, the dog equated the scent of Vietnamese or virtually anybody non-American as bad,
mm-hmm.
and an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And in the rear area, if a dog ever got loose, it was shot immediately. It was killed. Because if it ever came across a Vietnamese, it'd kill a Vietnamese.
Right.
But we really loved having them. I know there was a company operating parallel to us that ran into some North Vietnamese. It was a big firefight. The dog handler was shot and wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And the enemy took off, and they tried to get to the dog handler, but the dog was so protective, he wouldn't even let a medic near him. He knew the handler was injured.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally had to shoot the dog.
Jeez.
So that they could save the medic, the dog handler's lives. And those dog handlers, they ever lost their dog, it was like they just lost their brothers or something.
Mm-hmm.
The dog and the handler were, you know, one and one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told they never brought any of them back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
But then I've heard that they did. Well, after the Second World War, they did. But I don't know if I would trust rehabilitating one of those dogs, having been in the kind of situations they were in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we always loved having them whenever we could get them.
How would you change your tactics at all or do anything differently when you had them?
They were always on point.
Okay.
and everybody was usually a lot more relaxed because if you're coming up on an enemy force, you had a little bit of a notice. Mm-hmm. Most contacts are random meetings on trails and the like. Mm-hmm. Or if you were coming up on a base camp or an ambush, mm-hmm. again, you'd have some notice.
Mm-hmm.
The dogs were trained not to bark. I don't think I ever heard one bark. Just to point, go into a pointing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were really upset, a very low, low, low growl.
Mm-hmm.
And right away, then the dog handler would have the dog sit down. The dog would still be alerted. And then we'd start sending out patrols, you know, out to the right and out to the left
mm-hmm.
to go and investigate.
Mm-hmm.
They could also find booby traps. Like I said, I don't know why they didn't have more so that each company could have a dog handler.
Mm-hmm.
We could have been much, much more efficient.
It sure sounds like it.
Yeah, it was. We loved having them.
Yeah. Did you guys use snipers a lot?
We didn't. The Marine Corps used a lot of them. We had them. But and I've seen them, but we didn't have any assigned to my company at all.
Okay.
Or any of the companies I was in.
Okay.
Trying to think if once in a while one man would carry an M14 without a scope,
mm-hmm.
because that's a very long range weapon compared to an M16.
Mm-hmm.
But generally we all carried for rifles M16s or shotguns.
Did you come across any unusual wild animals?
Yeah, mongooses.
Okay.
An orangutan once. What an ugly, dirty animal they are. Oh, God, they always look like they need a bath. Some snakes. When I went over there, I thought, you know, there'd be a snake around every corner.
Right.
But considering all the amount of time I spent in the jungle out there, I can count the number of times that I came across a snake or saw one easily on both hands with some change left over. They had some pretty poisonous snakes there.
Mm-hmm.
They had bamboo vipers, which are probably the equivalent of a rattlesnake. They weren't real bad. One of the worst was a banded krait. I don't know if you ever heard of something called a zang-zang or a two-step.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
A lot of people got those confused with bamboo vipers or cobras,
right.
But they weren't. They were banded krites. And come to find out, they have a very small mouth, and they're a very docile snake.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ever got bit by one, you were in super trouble. Cobras I saw once.
What would you guys do when you came across a snake? Would you kill it or go around it or?
You didn't want to shoot it usually because you didn't want to make the noise.
Mm-hmm.
It might get chopped with a machete. There were several incidents I can remember. On my very first time out in the field,
mm-hmm.
Word came up to stop. And then word came up from man to man, passing word forward up to company commander, that they had found a sick snake on the trail, and they wanted permission to shoot it.
Okay.
And I can remember hesitating a second. They found a sick snake on the trail, but I passed it forward, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what had happened was like one of those things where if you start on one side of the room and somebody whispers a phrase or a message, by the time it gets to the end of the room, it gets changed.
Right.
Well, what had happened was the guy had fallen. And when he went to get up off to the side of the trail, suddenly here's a snake.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what kind, but it was in a striking posture.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't dare move.
Mm-hmm.
And they were asking permission to shoot the snake to save the guy. Well, they just plain should have shot the snake.
Right.
But somebody, some sergeant or something, well, we better ask first. Meanwhile, this poor sucker's, you know, they're halfway to get up, just frozen solid,
mm-hmm.
and the sweat pouring off him.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the word coming, hearing the company commander being real annoyed, that's a sick snake. What the hell are you talking about? And somebody, not him, but somebody went back, and then I heard a gunshot, and then the word came up as to what would really happen.
Mm-hmm.
myself once, we'd pulled in for the afternoon, and there was a lot of heavy brush, and sometimes you clear it by just falling backwards on your rucksack, mm-hmm. and a rucksack being so big and heavy, it crushed down some of these reeds and the like to clear an area. Mm-hmm. Well, I did this, and I fell down once, and I went to get up, and there was this little itty-bitty brown snake, maybe about 3 inches long, and half of its body was trapped underneath a reed that had been bent down. Mm-hmm. But this little brown snake is trying his damnedest to bite my leg, my thigh. And he can't quite reach my thigh. And he's got a little itty-bitty mouth. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what kind of snake it was. I just know that he wasn't afraid, and he was trying his damnedest. In fact, he probably couldn't even have penetrated my fatigue pants. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't get up because I was up against some trees and the like on my right side. He was on the left side. And I'm saying to this guy, I forget who it was, you know, whoever, kill it, kill it, kill it. And he's saying, kill what? The snake. What snake? Well, it's this little itty-bitty thing, brown. And finally he saw it, you know, and I'm trying to back up against the tree. So, boom, he crushed it with his rifle butt. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had no idea what it was. It's just that, you know, it was a snake acting very aggressively.
Right.
One time in the Tuiwai area, we were coming out of a forested area out into savanna lands. And right at the line, there was this little break opening, and then it came out into the savanna lands, and I was in the second platoon back. And all of a sudden, all this firing broke out in front. Mm-hmm. Out in the savanna lands, about, 50 meters away or so. And we all drop to the ground, and every other man alternates right and left, right and left. Mm-hmm. And heard the firing, and then nothing, and then nothing, and then nothing, and then all of a sudden, word coming down the line, okay, get up, let's go on. Well, what the hell's going on? Well, we went on forward, and I looked down, and here's the biggest snake I ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. A python, uh-huh. twisting and rolling in the grass. Well, the point man had been going through this grass about 2 feet high, mm-hmm. and it stepped on this thing thinking it was a log, and it moved.
Oh, geez.
So him and the other guy just fired it up
uh-huh.
for what they got chewed out for. Because, hey, it's a snake. Don't worry about it. The head's way up there. You can tell by the size of the body.
Right.
But that was about the biggest snake I ever saw. Other times I can think of was up in some mountains with a lot of rocks. There was like this hole in the rocks. I guess you could call it a den almost.
Mm-hmm.
And there must have been about 12 cobras down there. Mm-hmm. And it was right near where we just set up. Well, the word went down and guys started walking over there. And like some teenagers will do, a few picked up some sticks and walked down into the den to play with the cobras. And you know the cobras are aggressive. They will come at you, but they don't strike real fast because they don't strike. They kind of fall forward
mm-hmm.
fast, and these guys are kind of like sword fighting with them.
Jeez.
So finally, a sergeant comes along and get your fucking asses out of there. What the hell's the matter with you? You get bitten by one of those things, you know. It depends on how quickly the chopper can get out here. So they pulled them all out. And they posted a guard over there
mm-hmm.
to keep guys away and to make sure the snakes didn't come out.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some nervousness by guys on that side of the perimeter that night.
I can imagine.
But there was no problem with the snakes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there may have been a couple of other times, but very, very rare. I found out since then that down in rice paddies, on the average, there's 2 cobras for every rice paddy square. But you never saw them,
right?
Because we're considered too big. And I'm sure there were a lot that just plain got out of the way
mm-hmm.
when they heard us or felt us by coming, the vibration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very rare.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw tigers twice.
Did you?
Helicopters were flying overhead, and they had a dead tiger slung by the paw underneath, and I was really amazed at the size of these things. I'd seen tracks a couple times, and then during my third tour, we were pulling an ambush next to a stream, and there was heavy brush around it, and there was a trail running through it,
mm-hmm.
and some guy said, "Do you hear that?" I said, "What?" and I heard something crack, like a little twig or something, mm-hmm. and then another one, and it kind of moved around, and suddenly, you ever heard a tiger give these real low guttural?
Yes.
Kind of? Yeah, something like that came. And boy, I'm talking, you had a squad of guys more frightened than if we had had a platoon of North Vietnamese around us. And everybody sitting there with weapons ready on full automatic in case this thing jumped out of the dark.
Uh-huh.
And it walked around our position on the riverside maybe two or three times, and then we never heard it again. So we were concerned for the rest of the night.
Mm-hmm.
But the tracks were huge. And those two I saw under the helicopter, knowing how big a helicopter was,
mm-hmm.
you know, you could judge the size of these tigers, and they were just massive.
Mm-hmm.
God, they were huge. I've seen elephant tracks. I didn't see any elephants.
Yeah.
Like I said, mongooses, monkeys. There were deer around. They had bears over there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see any. They call them moon bears. And I'm sure some other animals that just plain got out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Some freakish birds. One bird, I could just barely hear it through the trees. We were crossing over the top of a ridge line, and it sounded like an artillery round coming in. The kind of a... And everybody dropped down, and you could look up through the trees, and this bird was a light yellow, but you couldn't see it because of the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a wingspan on it, and I swear to God, the wingspan was 10 feet. And it flew right over us and just kept on going. But nobody could really see it clearly because of the leaves of the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, it's always, you know, I wonder what kind of bird that was. It was that big.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds as big as a condor, you know? And it was a light yellow.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know. They had some, I didn't see any squirrels, but they had these little mammals.
Mm-hmm.
They used to race around. At night when you're pulling guard, you could hear. You could tell a little mammal, but a little scurrying
mm-hmm.
and a quick stop, and a little scurrying and a quick stop,
mm-hmm.
just like you can tell if a human being's out there or the mm-hmm. size of an animal.
Mm-hmm.
This thing about Viet Cong, North Vietnamese, going through the jungle like a cat is a bunch of bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
No one goes through the jungle like a cat except a cat.
Right.
And chances are you're going to hear it
mm-hmm.
if you're listening. But I can remember hearing these little, and they must have been little mice-like rodents. You hear them, they'd scurry, then stop.
Mm-hmm.
Scurry, then stop. It was interesting to listen to,
mm-hmm.
but we knew what they were, some sort of little rodent.
Mm-hmm. Now, the rats have become infamous, the Vietnamese rats. Usually back in the rear.
Yep. Never saw them in the field. I've seen one. Heaven help any cat that ever ran into it. I remember it having a real large, rounded back.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing must have been, minus the tail, 18 inches long.
Gosh.
And like I said, the back, as it came towards the butt end of the rat, went up kind of sharply and then curved down.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see that many in the rear because my only time in the rear was really when I was a gunner.
Mm-hmm.
But I had heard an awful lot and read an awful lot about the rats, but that's the only one that I saw. I'm sure with the mess halls around and the like, even though we maintain sanitation very strictly, armies, of course, up until the end of the First World War, most casualties were actually from disease.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we learned sanitation was a big deal. You didn't just leave food laying around, stuff like that. But I imagine they must have found something someplace. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, sir, why don't we go ahead and take a break for today?
Okay.
It's about that time. So we'll sign off now and we'll pick up later.
Okay.